Extra, extra, read all about it.
RandomChatter.com presents...
Agent Carter, you are going to run S.H.I.E.L.D.
Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files.
I go to work.
With your hosts, Directors Shepard and Stolte.
You boys play nice.
I have orders for Agent Carter.
Calling all junior agents of the Strategic Scientific Reserve. It's now time for Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, brought to you by Aspirinol, medicated with the latest scientific remedies that are endorsed by medical authorities to cut short a cold. Don't let that cold run into something worse. Stop it now with Aspirinol. I'm Station Chief Shepard.
And I'm Station Chief Stolte.
And today we're bringing you the continuing adventures of Peggy Carter as she fights for truth, justice, and equal pay. Join us each and every week as we marvel at Agent Carter and show you that we're in the know. Well, Josh, welcome back to another exciting episode of Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files. I am really digging this season. They are still being kind of slow and methodical. I find that I feel they're taking kind of the Netflix route of story building. I didn't have anything to compare it against last season, I guess, but now with Daredevil and Jessica Jones behind us, it seems like, you know, we get stuff going on in the episode, but they're really building characters, and it's meant to, you know, be the season is meant to be viewed kind of as a mini movie, I feel.
Definitely. And I think last season did that too, if we were to go back and watch it. We may have even mentioned it somewhere in the first third of the season. I think it kind of slowed down a little bit, but this one doesn't seem to be slowing down too much.
No, and probably because, you know, they're kind of getting into that metaphysical, you know, mystery. Right now, this is a little more X-Files than the X-Files.
Oh,
which is enjoying a revival right now.
Interesting. Yeah, it does feel very X-Filey, but in a good way. Not in a ripoff kind of
way. Not the,
well,
not
no,
the
no, I didn't mean
X-Files
that bad against X-Files, but I mean like you know, because of number one, it's kind of a, you know, a period piece where, you know, in the 40s when you don't see a lot of this stuff take place in, you know, things that took place back then in old movies, especially. I guess there's not a lot of TV shows that took place back then, but
right.
And it could feel really, really hokey, but it doesn't. It feels more like a, you know, Marvel comic book.
Yeah. Well, I feel there's a mix of styles, and we talked a little bit about this last week in terms of you've got the noir feel, but you've also got some of the slapstick, the kind of screwball comedy aspects of it from the American films from the time period, you know, with the Cary Grant and others from that era. So, but we'll get into that a little bit more. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the episode that we're going to discuss this week?
All right, episode 4 from season 2 of Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D., Smoke and Mirrors, which aired on Groundhog Day. So I watched it twice. So that was good.
Oh, good.
February 2nd, 2016 was when it originally aired, and it was written by Sue Chung and directed by David Platt.
Got it. Did the groundhog see the smoke and mirrors?
The groundhog, I think he did not see smoke, but he did see mirrors.
Which means you may
be getting another 4 feet of snow some weekend soon. I think that's what that means.
All right.
Well, now you've heard the saying sugar and spice and everything nice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what little girls are supposed to be made of.
Correct.
Yeah, but if you're Agnes Cully, it might be things like books and science and doses of tragic backstory. This week we learn how the unfortunate upbringing of Agnes has led to her zero matter powerhouse that she is today. But, you know, not all tragic pasts turn you into a monster. We also learn about the road Peggy traveled, and that's what put her on the road, you know, where she is today. And now that she's in the sights of Vernon Masters, well, he's going to shut her investigation down. because, you know, he's not a nice man. He's really
I thought that he was asking her to go surfing because he was saying there's a big tidal wave coming. I got to watch that again. I must.
You know what? They are in L.A., so it could be.
Right. Well, I mean, Rose was surfing, so you can see why I made that mistake.
We can analyze that a little bit. Maybe that's later on in the season. I took it a little different way, but
I would love
we
to.
Could, we could love to see him go surfing. What kind of swimsuits did they wear back in the 40s? It wasn't those long, stripy ones that the guys wore. That was more in the early 20th century, wasn't it?
Right. That would have been, like the 1920s, probably.
They had
nicer swimsuits in the late 40s.
Yeah, I think Vernon Masters might still have one of those, though. Well, now that he's going to...
have one of the old ones.
Yeah, exactly. Now that he's going to shut her investigation down, right, because she's getting closer to exposing Chadwick and the Arena Club and everything that goes along with that, which I still think there's much, much more than we have seen so far, but we will see. But don't worry, you know, because with Jarvis and Sousa on her team, they might just be able to succeed. I'm guessing.
Seems like it.
Seeing how they're good guys, and that's what this, you know, season's about.
Right, and this is not named, you know, Vernon Masters of the FBI. So
no, that's the spinoff.
Yeah. So
that'd be a spinoff of a spinoff of a spinoff, I think.
Well, they're kind of getting there. I mean, you know, ABC is developing the spinoff with Hunter and Mockingbird from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. There is another live action TV show that they're working on, which may or may not be a spinoff of something else, but it doesn't, you know, it's will be a superhero property from Marvel made for ABC TV. And I think they've also got like a half-hour comedy they're working on based on the Damage Control comic series, which is really about the guys that clean up after Thor and Captain America and the Hulk smash through different cities. I've heard that is trying to be done in the style of The Office, which I think could be kind of funny, though I'm kind of done with the style of The Office shows. That's just a little overused right now. But we don't have any other information on any of those. So I'm was trying to dig up some news this week. The best thing I can tell you right now is that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. at this point returns on March 8th. We talked about this when we were having our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. case file show, that they were coming back on the 8th. But because Agent Carter got delayed 2 weeks from its start because of the presidential State of the Union address, we're not sure if actually Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is going to get bumped out 2 more weeks, so it would return in towards the end of March. Because right now, if we look at Agent Carter, March 1st puts us on the 8th episode, and then there would still be 2 episodes after that, unless they're going to double up those last 2 weeks in some fashion. So we'll probably know a little bit more closer to the end of February, I'm guessing.
All right. Well, and when we do find out, we will let you guys know for sure.
Yeah, we're going to just keep it a secret because we like having that power over.
Well, no, some things are need to know. You know, that's top secret information.
I need to take off my Arena Club pin. I'm having impure thoughts here, so let me just put this down here. So, all right. So, Smoke and Mirrors. Interesting title. That is, I don't really know where it derives from, but it's sort of a might come from magicians or something along that line. Basically, it's something that's deceitful, something that is obfuscated or inveigled from the viewer.
Yeah, that's what they would say. You know, magicians use to fool people with their tricks. You know, and so that became kind of a I don't know, what do you call that, an idiom?
Whatever you want to call me, it's fine.
All right. So there was some of that going on, but there's always some of that going on.
Well, it is a spy show. I mean,
right.
So yeah, you've got that. But I found it interesting because, you know, the smoke is something that is used to obscure, right? It's something that usually, you know, like a smoke screen, right? Something that you put up so that people can't see what you're really doing. But the mirror is something that reflects and usually shows you an image of yourself back. Now, physically, there were a lot of mirrors in this episode. Whitney Frost is almost always surrounded by a mirror in different scenes, especially in her dressing room. She has been studying the, scar on her head, like the crack, whatever we want to call the thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like a zero matter scar is almost what it is. Plus, that sounds way better than that she's studying her crack in the mirror.
Yeah. This is a PG rated show, so let's.
No, you know, I mean, just because it's like she's cracked skin, you know, but it almost right. seems like it's leaking out, doesn't it?
It does. It's at that first week, I thought it was kind of oozing out, but as it opens up, you know, it's almost like I think I mentioned this on our first show that it's kind of just under her skin, and you know, it's almost like she has this porcelain skin that has cracked, and it's revealing the. Yuck, you know, underneath.
That's a great analogy with the porcelain, you know, because she's kind of like the doll, you know, the pretty doll, which is
right,
what they address that right. in this episode, too, with her looks.
Yeah, definitely. But the other thing that I want to address just with the mirror, so I think the smoke is kind of, you know, there's a lot of smoke in this episode. You've got different characters trying to hide things from one another. You've got Vernon Masters kind of throwing up a smoke screen to protect the members of the Arena Club, and we can get into talking more about that. And you've got Peggy and Sousa, you know, kind of throwing up their own smoke as they investigate Hunt and, you know, lie to him basically about the fact that they're giving him this disease, which turns out to be a cold. just a cold? No, an intense cold. So, the mirror I thought was really interesting because the reflection of Peggy to Agnes Cully, a.k.a. Whitney Frost, they are the reflections of one another. This is a great episode because it's kind of like we got the secret origin of Agent Carter and the secret origin of Whitney Frost in the, you know, two origin stories for one. A lot of backstory on Carter that we haven't seen, but there are these two characters that are very similar, and but from a young age, we saw how, you know, like, I guess nature versus nurture works for them, and they kind of ended up, well, I guess Peggy ends up kind of becoming who she is intends to be. She puts on airs for a while and tries to be someone she's not, getting the job at Bletchley Park, which was where the Enigma machine was, where they were doing all the code breaking for World War II, as seen in The Imagination Game with Benedict Cumberbatch. If you haven't seen that, it's a pretty good movie. And so she tries to do that, and she's going to get married, and then she realizes that that's not who she is, and she becomes, you know, her true self and kind of lives up to what her brother has held her up to, whereas Agnes was always being herself, very inquisitive, very science-driven. If they had STEM back then, she would have been, you know, a huge proponent of that, I believe. But she was being told by people that, you know, looks were really the only thing that were important. And so she decides then to live basically the rest of her life as a lie. I thought that was a really interesting parallel/reflection with the stories of these two ladies.
Yeah, for sure. And, yeah, I mean, so, you know, a mirror reverses things or makes them opposite. And they, the two of their lives are very much opposite in a lot of different ways. So I like your analysis and explanation of how they're different. That's I thought that a little bit, you know, and kind of looked at them as contrasting characters, but I like that you use the mirrors to illustrate that. And the smoke, you know, for Agnes, the smoke is, like you said, so she's living a lie, so changed her name and being something that she's not. But for Peggy, you know, it's to me, the smoke seems, well, she's a spy, you know, so she has secrets and things that she has to cover up. And again, this season, she's having to go behind the people in charge, I guess, you know, to do what she believes is right, which is solve the case, which is the same thing she had to do last year. And ultimately, they understood what she was doing last year and kind of backed her up. But she still had to kind of go behind their backs to figure it all out. Luckily, well, she seems to have a little more support this year.
She does seem to, and I'm glad that Sousa is trying to stick by her, you know, which part of it seems like he's doing it because, you know, he's the boss, right? And it's the right thing to do and everything. But also part of it, in this episode, I think you feel a little bit more, he's still got feelings for her.
He does.
Especially at the point where he sees her being tender with Dr. Wilkes. Even though this dude's not even physical, like, Peggy is still having this very intimate relationship with this spectral guy. And I think...
Spectral guy. Is that his comic book name, Spectral Guy?
Spectral Guy, yeah. very Ghostbusters-ish. But, you know, I think Sousa still has issues, he's not happy with who he is because of his injury and stuff. I still don't think he's over that. He's with Violet, but I think he still really wants to be with Peggy.
You know, he's kind of lying to himself the same way Peggy was in her past, right? He's doing this because it seems like the right thing to do. We don't know as much about where he is as a character right now and, you know, how he feels about his fiance and that kind of thing. But, I mean, it's pretty obvious, you know, even just based on these little glances and looks that he's giving right now, that he's not completely content with the decisions that he's made up to this point.
Right.
But you can tell he's still a good guy and he's still trying to do the right thing.
And I hope he continues being a good guy. I would hate for, we've got two characters in the SSR, Sousa and Thompson, who are both leaders of their respective divisions, right? The West Coast versus the East Coast. And I hope they keep Sousa continuing to be a, you know, kind of a forthright, honest, ethical sort of guy who's always fighting for the right thing. Because right now they're taking Thompson down that path where he's corrupted. You know, he's the guy that's going to be, selling...
Causing problems.
Causing problems and, you know, selling contraband during the war and stuff like that because, you know, hey, you know, why not? It's, you know, it's a war. You know, no one's going to hold me accountable for certain things.
At this point, and then maybe they'll turn this around, but at this point I still see Thompson as a good guy who... It makes impulsive decisions and not always the right thing, you know, but it's a guy who's got ideas in his head about the way things should be. And he's learning that they're not, you know, especially with women and, you know, like last season, Sousa
like
a lot with his
works.
Injury. Yeah. The way the world works. Right. But what he's realizing is that that's not always the case. It isn't always like he's been told and taught, and he still wants to do the right thing, but he has to put this, vision of himself to everybody that he's kind of a tough guy and a macho guy, and so I still think he is a good guy. I don't think he's
okay
gone the road of the corrupt, at least not yet.
That's true. Well, we didn't see him this week, but yeah, that was true. The last thing we got from him last week was he kind of seemed to realize that he was on slippery ground, mm-hmm. I guess. But yeah, I mean, definitely an interesting character. I really enjoy that they're taking the time to flesh these characters out. The Sousa character is growing on me. He's almost a little too mopey. Just to be super likable right now, but you know, he's got some charm, and we're getting, definitely this week we got a lot more of him. He knows exactly what's going on. I mean, there's a reason why he's in charge of the LA branch. You know, he's not an idiot, so it's cool. talking about the the mirroring of these two female characters, you know, obviously two strong female characters on a female driven show. I thought it was really cool that there were these two descriptions of the women by the men on the show. So early on, Dr. Wilkes is talking about Whitney Frost, and Carter says, "So she's a genius." And he says, "Well, I'm a genius. Whitney Frost defies categorization."
Yes. He's very impressed with her.
Oh, yeah. He's totally, I mean, from an intellectual level, he's totally smitten. He's empirically decided that, you know, there is no categorizing her just because of her intelligence. I mean, when she was 8 or 9 or something like that, you know, she's fixing a radio. I mean, that's, I don't know.
And just by know if I could taking fix it apart radio. And looking at it.
Right. I mean, I could take apart an old radio, but all I end up doing is like giving myself a shock. So
I did used to do that when I was a kid. I used to tinker and take things apart. But
well, I used to take stuff apart.
That's how
all the
we
time.
Got a lot of broken things in our house because I never knew how to put them back together.
I took apart one of my Star Wars toys and didn't realize, oh, there's springs and stuff, and then I could not get it back together. It was,
my favor, I had a much happier child life than Agnes did. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. And then later, Vernon Masters relates Thompson's assessment to Peggy that she is, quote, quite the independent thinker, which I thought it was funny. He goes, he meant it as a compliment. And she's like, if I know him, he meant it as an insult, you know. But you've got these two women that are kind of outside the boundaries of the stereotypical role for women of the time. And, you know, one defies categorization, the other's an independent thinker. Those are great things to aspire to, but back then, I could totally see these as being like, you know, you would list these on the negative, you know, as negative impacts or something.
Well,
traits.
If not blatantly, Agnes's mother said exactly that to her. That, you know, if you want to get anywhere in this world, you got to focus on the face. You got to focus on your looks. I mean, she told her that in a very, you know, emotionally abusive way.
Well, I had put down that Agnes learned that she needed to become more like someone else. But then when I watched it again, it's like, no, her mom told her, it's like, you know, why are you wasting time thinking about stuff? Because this is the only thing that matters. And she grabs her face and shows it to her in a mirror. Right. So again, there's that reflection staring back at her.
Oh, yeah. Oh, another mirror. Wow. I should have paid more attention to the actual literal mirrors in this. I bet you there was a lot of good, I don't know, indicators and symbols as they were showing those. But one thing I think, though, about Agnes using her looks for that, you know, you mentioned that she learned that or, you know, her mom told her that. I don't think she was ever really convinced of that, though. Instead, what I think she did is she used it to her advantage to continue to get what she wanted, instead of just being content in that role of pretty woman and actress and, you know, starlet and things like that. Go ahead.
No, I just finished your thought. That's fine.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think she really was, and I think it made her bitter. I think it made her bitter that she couldn't openly be who she wanted to be and who she really was. But, you know, she kind of used that to her advantage, which is why I think she's with Chadwick and is you know, gets the things that she gets now. So
I don't discount any of that, because they said by 1938 she was already whatever, one of the top actresses for Anvil Studios, which is the company that Ned Silver, Talent Agent to the Stars, worked for, which was only 4 years after she was discovered, quote unquote, in front of that theater. Okay, so that was 1934. So the flashbacks we saw for Agnes was 1920, where she was like, you know, 8, 9. I think her birth year was 1911, based on the birth record we saw in the previous episode. And then we went to 1928 when she was a teenager, and then 1934 for her. Peggy, we started with her as a young girl, probably about the same age as Agnes, but I'm not sure exactly what year that would have been when she's fighting the dragon. And then we spent the rest of the time with Peggy in the 1940, in the year 1940 at Bletchley Park, and then at her engagement party, and then presumably on her right before her wedding. So, but I don't discount any of that. I think she does use her looks to her advantage because she is so smart. I felt, though, that the immediate scene that we saw at the end of the episode where she was being discovered by the agent, I think she was really lost at that point. Like, she didn't have enough money for a ticket and she was for the movies, and she was using that as kind of her escape. I don't think she intended to get that the theater girl to give her a ticket.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think she intended to be found by this guy. And, you know, she was really depressed, but he says smile. And so I think it was just kind of that nervous reflex that caused her to smile. I really felt she was a lost soul at that point. But when he offered her the ability to become a model and potentially an actress and be on the star, you know, then immediately all the little wheels started clicking into place in her head and she saw where she could go with it. So I think
that's the point, I think, at which she realized, oh, I can,
that was the turn.
I can use this. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But again, it was great because we got a lot of backstory on Peggy, which is cool. I would never have guessed that, you know, she would have gone through this kind of, phase of not wanting to be an agent, you know, being a strong girl and then kind of hiding that again, probably because that's how she was able to fit in. She had all these female friends in the code breaking pool or whatever it is there. She had a fiance. It was like, it was all, you know, going to work out great for her.
I thought it was really interesting that they used Peggy's flashbacks. We haven't ever seen anything like that with her, you know, other than, you know, some scenes with Captain America and things like that, but not as far as her backstory goes. And do you think this is something that they're going to explore a little bit more? I mean, they've done that pretty successfully on other superhero shows, a little bit on Flash and definitely on Arrow. Or do you think that was more just to kind of reflect Agnes's backstory so you could see how they're different for this one single episode?
Yeah, I think it was more kind of just for this episode, you know, indicating that, you know, we've got our hero and we've got our villain. And, you know, the best heroes are the complete antithesis of the villain, you know, very much like Mr. Glass is in Unbreakable, Night Shyamalan film. So I think it was important to show Agnes's backstory, and by virtue of doing that, they were able to say, okay, well then here's how our heroine came to be. And while they might revisit some of this stuff later, I don't feel they need to. I think they probably, it served its purpose right now. Unless there's other information they want to get out to us at some point that this might work. The final thing I wanted to mention about this is that I found it, what I found really interesting about this, just, you know, you see a lot of, you know, war movies and stuff where the generals or whoever, you know, come to someone's door to say that, you know, their child has been lost. You know, I'm kind of thinking Saving Private Ryan right now, where they're like, you know, we got to pull this guy out of the field because his three brothers have died and everything. So Peggy is, presumably, I'm going to say the eve of her wedding day. She's trying on her dress. Her mom goes to answer the door. Peggy looks out the window, and in a very emotional moment, she realizes that her brother has died over in the battle in Europe. And that moment spurs Peggy on to be true to herself and basically honor her brother by being who she was meant to be, because the person that he saw, the person that he supported, you know, which was awesome, and go and join the SEO. But my immediate thought when I saw that was like, oh my gosh, so now your mom's just having to deal with burying a son and now your daughter runs off to join the war as well? What kind of hell is that on the mom? I mean, she can't even find her handkerchief as it is, let alone, she has to finish burying one child, and just think about the stress that it would put on the mom. And that's what struck me. That's not the point of the scene, but that's what I was thinking about.
No, yeah, that would be tough. It's interesting because what struck me right after, as she was sort of packing up to leave, I was kind of wondering how long it had been between her wedding and the time that she was leaving. You're right. I think that would be very hard on the mom. Although I would speculate that because her brother was an honorable guy and loved Peggy and told her to be true to herself. She, I think, was that kind of person too, and lived in a loving family with her brother being so close to her. I would guess that her mom, they raised them well, and she would understand and probably instilled a lot of those values in the both of her kids. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm assuming they all have two, but but you're right. I mean, that would be hard on any parent, of course, but I bet you she'd be okay. What was interesting to me is it felt like she never came back. As she was walking out that room, I felt like, I bet you she never has been back to that house. So maybe her mom died while she was at war or something like that. But it just felt like a final goodbye to the room and to her old life.
Yeah. Well, it was, that again, symbolically. And if you notice, again, in that whole sequence, Peggy was being presented through mirrors. Or through pieces of glass. She was, when she sees the news, the camera's outside the window.
Oh my gosh, look at that. Even after thinking about the title and really looking at all those different aspects, I missed so many of those things. That's fantastic, though, that they really used those in a way that wasn't obvious and really fit the idea of the story.
The show is so cinematic. I mean, it's... And by saying cinematic, I don't mean like epic or sweeping, like the grandness of certain movies, but it really uses setting and scene and the props to, explain a lot of stuff about the characters.
Uh-huh.
As another example, I talked about this last week, how in the background of Whitney's dressing room, there are the comedy and tragedy masks. And
oh, right.
The Whitney Frost character is a character called Madame Mask in the comic books. There was a scene here where she's sitting at a dressing table and the camera's kind of spinning around, like panning around her or something. And right through the foreground, little teeny models of the comedy and tragedy masks, like on a little stand or something, just like a little paperweight or a desk lamp or something like that. It fits because it's part of show business, but it's also, the masks that this character wears. She's wearing her comedy mask in public and her tragedy mask in private right now, but I feel like those are about to switch, or the tragedy mask, is obviously going to take over as she has now become more comfortable with her powers and is, using them more so.
Definitely.
She keeps killing people. I mean, I would assume killing rats only makes the scar grow a little bit, but after, taking Hunt out, she's got a thing, basically goes from her temple down to her jaw. It's, she needs to slow down a little bit.
It seems to me as if the more she does that, the more it kind of grows inside her and gives her kind of a thirst to do it. I don't know if that's true or not, but, or maybe she just gets more comfortable with it. I did think it was really interesting that she seemed to be very concerned with that scar on her head, and tried to cover it up at least until this episode. And then she very openly, let it show after Chadwick saw what she did.
She's gone through her scientific method, right? She's now experimented with all these rats and has obviously become comfortable with whatever this is, or understands it enough to know that it's, part of her now.
Right. Yeah. And so then she kept doing it. And I, as soon as she, destroyed that first poor rat, she saw that it grew and yet all the rats were gone later on, so you could see she was still experimenting with how to use it or how to have more control over it, right? Because the first rat, she couldn't do it on her own until the rat bit her.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I'm, you know, obviously she figured it out. But, so I just thought it was interesting because at first she was very concerned with her looks and how that was going to affect her, but then she embraced it. I don't know if that's the right word or not, but
she's kind of going back to her original state of that scientific inquiry and, you know, being more of who she is rather than the pretty face. So,
yes.
You know, I would assume by the end of the season here that, you know, she will be who she is intended to be, which is probably the person she always was, but because of all the problems with her childhood, and I'm assuming, you know, not an easy time in Hollywood. I just picture her, you know, being as flirtatious and pliable as possible in the, you know, in the casting couch scenario and everything like that, that she's a very broken person, and, you know, she's going to get this power that's just, it's literally, I believe it is eating her inside, you know, I mean, it's the physical manifestation of this dark force, this zero matter is that it, you know, is inside her and seeping out through this crack in her and stuff like that.
Yeah. Hey, on a side note, right now, if you have Amazon Prime, you can get free shipping on rats.
Oh, excellent.
So just to keep that in mind, you know, if you're experimenting with anything.
See, now, I live and work in Baltimore, so I actually do not need shipping on rats. And those little white things they had on the show, I'm sorry,
those are not rats.
Well, those are the small kind. I'm talking rats that are the size of a cat.
Oh, okay. All right.
Where you actually think, oh, that's a funny cat walking. Wait a second. That's not a cat.
See, we don't have to worry about that too much around here. Not where I live. We have more rabbits than anything else right now. But
yeah. So the other interesting thing that's going on in the show that is almost more troubling to me than the zero matter is this kind of growing wave of the communist hysteria. We're about 7 years away in Showtime from the McCarthy hearings. Those happened in 1954. And we're, I believe, 1946 or 1947. I think we're 1947 based on the newspaper that we saw last week. So communism, for those that don't know, was an ever-growing fear in America, the Red Scare, the Red Menace. And the McCarthy hearings were kind of the pinnacle of this, where people were harassed for their beliefs, whether or not they were actually communists. They were, you know, brought in to have to testify before this Senate subcommittee. There was mention by Vernon Masters in this that they're not going to brand, you know, Peggy Carter as someone evil. Like, you think he's gonna out himself as working with the Arena Club, but he turns it into the, oh, you know what, we're going to blame, you know, we're going to say that you're a communist, or, you know, that you have friends that are communists. And at the time, that is like the kiss of death. That's it was just a thing. As soon as you were labeled as a communist or communist sympathizer, you couldn't get jobs. You know, Masters talks about deporting her. And my question to you is, do you think that the show is going to continue to brand the heroes of our show, Sousa and Carter, as communists in order to keep them apart from the mainstream? Or is this something that is just kind of that they're just doing in this particular episode because of the investigations and stuff?
No, you know what? I think that will continue to be a problem as it was in that era. Well, error too.
Yeah.
But The McCarthy hearings didn't take place from 7 years from here. Now, and it was 1947, by the way. That they said that on the first episode.
Okay.
But
the hearings were in 54 then.
So. Right. So the threat of communism, though, was starting to build very shortly after World War II. And so, before the McCarthy hearings, it was starting – people were starting to feel – threatened by what Russia was turning into, or I guess I don't know if it was the Soviet Union at that point or not. I'm not an expert in any of this. I just kind of remember from seeing other movies, and I even remember. Now I'm guessing you have seen the movie The Right Stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean that's a older movie back in the early 80s, I think.
83. Mm-hmm.
And it was about the space program, and yes. I remember. A scene in that where they were talking about not letting the media publish something that they had accomplished with a speed test or something flying, and they didn't want the Russians to get it because it had already started growing. I just kind of remember it from that. But so even though the McCarthy hearings don't happen for a while, it was starting to grow at this point. So I think it is something that they can use pretty well. And I'm sure Vernon Masters is one of those people that use that tool in his toolbox very effectively. Vernon Masters strikes me as somebody who doesn't necessarily believe a lot of the things that he talked about as far as Peggy Carter being a woman and things like that. He sees her as a serious threat. He knows it, but he can use people's attitude against women against her to kind of maybe not stop her, but keep her down.
He is all about smoke and mirrors. I mean, because he's talking about. There's a tidal wave coming, and he's like, oh, yeah, you're an independent thinker. I mean, he knows that entire scene between him and Peggy in the SSR office is just a thinly veiled interrogation of her. And, he's like, oh, you're not going to tell me who the, who the informant is? And she's like, why should I? It's like, and without saying it, she's like, we're following protocol. And he's like, yeah, you know what? It's and at this point, he also mentions the Hollywood 10, which were 10 filmmakers, mostly writers, I believe. A number of famous names that I know, but the one that our listeners might know would be Trumbo. That was the film that just came out at the end of 2015 here, nominated for a number of Academy Awards, about the blacklisting of all these Hollywood types and stuff. And that would have happened just about a year before the events in Agent Carter here. That was in July of 1946. So you're right. There was still a lot of public stuff going on. And, it'd be one of those things. It'd be like, where the kids on the schoolyard, instead of, giving you some kind of racial slur or something like that, they would, probably call you, a communist would be how they would insult you at the time. Like, that was so much publicized in the media that it would probably be – that would probably be a really bad thing to be called.
Oh, for sure.
So – but I find it really interesting that, they're playing the very real fears of communism and the – we always hear about communist propaganda, but there was plenty of American propaganda in this – arena as well. And you're right, Vernon Masters is kind of a master of that. I don't know that he necessarily believes what he says, but he does know how to play people, and he knows the buttons to push. And he's in a, he's an old white man who's in a position of extreme power, and he's using it for his personal gain. I don't really see any other way, to interpret that, I guess, at this point.
That is a bad guy trait in the, I guess in a lot of things, but not in the Marvel universe, but in the S.H.I.E.L.D. universe, on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and on Agent Carter. That's a big trait. Personal gain.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, he may not feel that he's doing anything wrong. He talks to Thompson in previous episodes about, doing the right thing. We can't let this film get out. Giving it to us, I would give you a medal if I could. It's the right thing to do. he's, you know, it's almost like he's trying to protect himself under the guise of, you know, national security, but covering for the moral lapses that he has or the ethical lapses that he has by, you know, using it again, using national security or whatever as the excuse. I'm interested to see. I want to see some more about him. I would like to have an episode kind of focused around him. We may as the season goes on here. So, okay. One other thing that we discussed a little bit last week was the kind of the humor of the series. We kind of vacillate between heavy drama and the noir aspects of the spy business here. With the comedy that Jarvis and Peggy provide. And this week did not disappoint. In fact, this week I feel they amped it up even a little bit more, verging on almost on the slapstick. I actually laughed out loud about three times in my first airing of this. And
what was this when go ahead. I don't want to take your...
I was going to say the one that stood out the most to me was when he got stabbed with the tranquilizer. And she asked him how he felt, and he was... Jarvis, and then collapses on his face. I mean,
you're right. I laughed at that too. It could be really hokey, but you know what? I find it really fun. I think
it
fits
so
in.
Broad. I mean, they're playing it so big, so much bigger than life for everything. You know, she's like, "Well, why do you have a tranquilizer gun? I hope it's not for the flamingo." And he's like, "Those koalas." You know, and you're like, "Oh my god, koalas? Really?" And he just, you know, he could have played it, you know, much quieter, but he's very broad. He's doing his American accent. Jarvis is doing that American accent, pounding on the door
fun.
For Hunt. "Ma'am, please go back into your domicile. Close the door. Close the door." And, you know, he's so blustery and just it's hilarious. I mean, I don't know what to do, but it almost feels like it's two different shows. I felt this week the marriage between the two parts worked better because of the transitions weren't as abrupt because we had the flashbacks. So we'd go from flashback to Peggy and Sousa having to do something to flashback to Peggy and Jarvis having some crazy thing going on, and then another flashback, and then, you know, back to more serious stuff. So last week it was kind of from really serious stuff to really broad comedy. So I don't know. It just seemed to work a little bit better for me this week.
I thought it was good. It was fine this week. You do have to be careful with that. I think they're going to have to, you know, put a little bit of that in each week, because that's one of the things that makes this show, gives it kind of its atmosphere. So I think, you know, every once in a while they may tip the balance just a little bit too much. That way, I haven't seen that necessarily yet. I'm just saying that's a danger. But I enjoy it. I I'm so easy to please when it comes to things like that. Those little nitpicky things don't ruin a show for me. It just hasn't been too hokey yet. Even when he's laying on the couch there, what did he say? Like, "I want to ride the big pony" or something. I don't remember.
Yeah,
what he said.
The big horsey.
The big horsey. Yeah.
And the fact that they're letting James Darcy and Haley Atwell do these kind of just crazy American accents. Haley's done an American accent, I think, in every episode except this one, and then James Darcy did his American cop, which is cool to see. There are other times I'm sure that they do American accents so they can, you know, play in those kind of shows. They're allowed to use their real accents for this show and kind of use, you know, these outlandish versions of American accents, or how, you know, it's probably one of the things like, how do you hear Americans, you know, and that's, they would go, well, they sound like this.
You know what? We've established that Peggy is a tough dame, I guess that'd be better than what we use to describe that these days. But, and I like when they establish her also as a wily person who can use disguises and kind of use people's view of women at this time period to get where she wants. So she's, you know, dressed up as somebody or using that accent or playing a character.
Well,
so I like
it's
that.
It's like
too.
Her boss at Bletchley Park said, it's like, we need someone to be able to walk down the street and not have you know, not have heads turn, and so we're recruiting women. It's brilliant. I mean, it was, you know, it's using it, when you, I don't really know too much about the, you know, the spy trade or anything like that. Again, other than what I see in
that's
in
what you say
fiction. Yeah, that's what I'm going to continue saying. But you know, you don't hire someone to be a spy and then force them into something that they're not comfortable with. You use people in the roles that they are naturally comfortable with or naturally fit under. So, you know, if there's someone that's good with languages, you know, they're going to be your language expert and do things with that. They're not going to put them in, you know, explosives or something like that. You know, it's so it's playing to everyone's strength. Well, yeah.
Yes.
So I don't know where I'm going with that, but
well, she's got a lot of strengths, so she can do a lot of different things. That's what makes her a good character.
I finally want to end with just a quick discussion about Dr. Wilkes, because I'm glad we're continuing to explore his condition. This week he appears to be seeing a crack in space, very reminiscent of the one that we see in the film from the previous episodes. Also, yeah, very similar to the shape of the crack on Whitney's face. You know, it appears to be, you know, an entrance maybe to that, the dark dimension, to where the zero matter came from. What are your thoughts about that and the dangers that are presented to Dr. Wilkes?
Well, I had a very strange first thought when I saw that. Maybe I'm completely off base here, but I thought it was interesting that he saw it on the chalkboard where Stark and Jarvis, or whoever, everybody that was helping, was writing equations to try to help him with this dilemma. I just thought it was interesting that it was there. And because it wasn't, I mean, I guess I can't say that it wasn't necessarily physically there. He saw it there. He was the only one that saw it there. But he didn't seem to see it everywhere he went. It was only there. He kept staring at that one spot.
Where Peggy interrupted him because he was kind of staring off into space, and I really didn't notice where he was looking, but he was over by the blackboard. So
yeah. Hmm. So that was my first thought. I'm like, that is interesting that maybe they're onto something with that formula that is connected somehow to that. And again, completely off base, but this is another thing that I made a connection to when I saw it, is how similar that idea was to Agent Coulson making all those scratches, those etchings on the wall when he was dealing with the alien stuff back on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, and again, GH-425, whatever it was, yeah.
425, 426, whatever it takes. But yeah. And again, I'm sure they're not related. I'm 99.9% positive that they're not.
There's a
related
visual correlation, but like from a storytelling standpoint, they're probably not related.
Right. So that's it. But I just thought it was interesting that that's where he saw it. The other thing that worries me, because of his little speech when Peggy caught him there and explaining how he felt, you know, how he was feeling really drained, or, you know, like, I'm very worried about Dr. Wilkes. I'm not sure how long he will be around, but I do not see a real happy ending for him. I like him. I hope that's not true, but
yeah. Well, I would assume at some point, so he and Whitney Frost were both created from the same incident. So I can only imagine from a storytelling standpoint that the two of them would have to come back together to resolve either one or both of their plot lines.
Yeah.
So,
I would say probably both. He might be crucial in stopping her at whatever she ultimately becomes, which is probably dangerous to everybody around.
Or maybe because of she's got the power, but he's still, you know, he's still him. Maybe he can use, because the power, the zero matter seems to flow out and into her, right? It's like, because she's a conduit. So maybe he can use her, like, physicality and the way that she handles the zero matter as a conduit to get back to the real world. So the same way she can absorb somebody into her, maybe he can enter through her and be, you know,
That's not the sound it's going to make, is it?
I don't know. It looks, it's gross looking, I got to tell you. So, and then last week, I think I was speculating that the security guard at the club was probably the same guy that attacked Peggy. We weren't really clear on that, but we got confirmation that Hunt was the security guard at the club and the one that attacked Peggy and Chadwick's driver.
Is it wrong that I kind of feel sorry for him?
No, I think they did. I think it means they did a good job rounding out this character. I mean, it's unfortunate, and you know, he was.
I mean, he was doing.
He was messing
with
some powerful people. Yeah, he was caught up with. Yeah, no, he was a bad dude.
I mean, he was a bad dude, but he kind of gave you his entire backstory, and you realized why he was a bad dude, and it was tragic. I mean, it was really, really sad, and he knew that no matter what, that was his destiny. And he was probably destined to die now at this point, especially since he gave, you know, Peggy the information that she wanted.
Yeah.
So he knew no matter what, he was dead. I don't know. So, I mean, like, he was a bad guy, but I had some sympathy for him.
That just speaks to the writing. I felt that a little bit. Though he confused me because he says, you know, they tied his hands together and they drug him around before breakfast and once before lunch. And then there wasn't lunch. And I'm like, wait, so if there wasn't lunch, does that mean they didn't drag you around? I wasn't following his weird little speech, but
he wasn't,
you know,
the brightest, you know,
PTSD, I'm sure, a little messed up from the war. So,
yeah.
I have some references and not necessarily comic book references, but just some other things that I wanted to point out from this episode. If you would indulge me.
Okay.
So Agnes's hometown is Broxton, Oklahoma, which is actually part of the Marvel comic universe. I guess it's a place where a number of Asgardians have lived. Like, it's actually I don't know if it's a real town in Oklahoma, but in the comic books, it's a town where people from Asgard seem to congregate for whatever reason.
Now, I would like to be able to say that I am up to speed on all my Asgardian history, but why Oklahoma?
I don't know. I would assume it has something to do with the wind and the plains sweeping over each other.
All right.
So, Jarvis gave the name checked Hedy Lamarr.
That's Hedley. Hedy. You're right.
No, in this case, it is Hedy.
Okay.
She was the real-life inspiration for the series Whitney Frost. She was an actress, but she was also a very intelligent woman of the 40s who helped come up with the what was it? It was the being able to change the codes on a rotating band so that the axis could not break the coded transmissions.
Yeah.
One of the names Hunt.
Legendary. Oh. Very cool story there. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, yeah. One of the names Hunt gave was Thomas Gloucester, the Wall Street man. He also gave Hugh Jones, who's the head of Roxxon. But Tom Gloucester was referred to as a character named Tom. He was kind of the balding guy with the white mustache from the first episode of the series. But we got his last name now, Thomas Gloucester. Gloucester Castle was the place in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. where they used the sonic device to open the monolith portal, if you've been watching that series. So ties to Hydra right there, which is interesting because one of the showrunners specifically denied the fact that even though the Arena Club symbol was similar to the symbol that we saw for the prototype Hydra group in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., they were not related.
I don't believe them.
Right. I believe that is more smoke and mirrors right there.
Ooh. Ooh, yeah. See, there you go. See, yeah. They're just using the title of this episode to...
Yep. And then Elliot Ness was mentioned. He was... you folks may know him best as the lead character in the Untouchables TV show and movie, but he was actually an actual FBI agent during this time. Actually, by this time, I think he was running for mayor or something like that.
Elliot Ness was in Waterworld, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah, yes, he was.
Robin Hood, something like that? Okay.
Robin Hood, Prince of Wolves?
Yeah, that's
like
it.
That. President McKinley was mentioned as one of the things that the members of the Arena Club, the Council of Nine, which we actually got a on-screen confirmation of that name that we've been using for a few weeks now, that they actually committed the assassination of him. President McKinley died in 1901 from a gunshot wound. Actually, he didn't die from the gunshot wound. He seemed to be getting better, but basically got gangrene in his stomach and died as his stomach kind of spilled out into his inner... Oh, that's gross.
Thank you for that historical lesson there. That's going to stick around with me for a while.
Well, there you go. That's the best lesson. And then the Hollywood 10, as I mentioned. Also, as a side note, the movie that Agnes was seeing at the movie theater was Teresa Montgomery in the Spanish Tower. Not a real film. The poster right behind Ned Silver, Talladega to the Stars, said that the film was directed by David Platt, who is the director of this episode of Agent Carter, and that the movie was part of was being released by Anvil Studios, which is, I believe, who Ned worked for, and that is the company that Whitney decided to join at as she made her mark in Hollywood. So
I love that you see those little details. That's so much
the more
fun.
You know. Yeah, so. A lot of cool stuff this week, and I guess that's all we've got for this week's Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, but be sure to join us next week as we see Peggy and her team assemble in hopes that they can figure out what Whitney Frost actually did to Mr. Hunt and bring truth and justice into the 1940s.
Excellent. Well, hey, if you guys enjoyed this episode of Agent Carter and also enjoyed listening to us talk about it on Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, we would love to hear from you. So if you could leave us feedback on iTunes, we would really appreciate that. And if you want to just contact us directly and give us your thoughts on Agent Carter and what you have noticed or ideas that you've had, speculation for where it's going, send us an email, shield@randomchatter.com, or you can go and tweet at us on Twitter @agentspodcast. And of course, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/agentspodcast.
You can also check out the other podcasts Josh and I host, including Green Justice, an Arrow podcast, and Scarlet Velocity, a Flash podcast, via the randomchatter.com network, and our newest partner, forcecast.net, on their Outer Rim network. All shows are also available in the iTunes Store and through Stitcher for Android or iOS. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please be sure to tell all your friends about us, and then all of you guys go and like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. So for Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, this is Jay.
And this is Josh.
Until next week, bidding you adios, auf Wiedersehen, aloha.
This podcast is not endorsed by ABC Television or Marvel Entertainment. The official website for Marvel's Agent Carter can be found at abc.go.com. Agent Carter and related elements are copyright Marvel Entertainment, LLC.